Can I take the blindfold off now?
Not yet, Mum.
You're not leading me into mild peril, are you, Latimer?
Certainly not, Mum.
I'm not going to find myself on the edge of a precipice or anything.
No, Mum.
When I said the next tea lair had to be something special, I didn't realise it would take weeks for you to find one.
I felt terrible about the pirate debacle, Mum. I can only assure you that Scurvy Pete will never be able to tell another lie again. You may remove the blindfold now, Mum.
This had better be impressive, Latimer. My social calendar has been empty for far too long and... Oh my goodness!
Tea and Jeopardy with Emma Newman.
There's always time for a nice cup of tea and a spot of mild peril. Well, hello there, my lovelies. I do hope you're well and haven't had a prized artifact stolen by a rival archaeologist. My name is Emma Newman, and I'd like to welcome you into my secret tea lair for polite conversation, abject geekery, a cheeky bit of cake, and of course, a nice cup of tea. I do hope you weren't too shocked by the sight of the giant silver bubble that's surrounding this rather beautiful Georgian townhouse when you arrived. I must confess I was rather taken aback by it myself. However, once you're inside the house, it doesn't feel any different, does it? Latimer explained it to me in great detail, but I won't bore you with such things as quantum physics when there's tea, cake, and good conversation to be had. Suffice it to say that the bubble creates a local space-time distortion, and if you feel a slight tingling in your toes, that's perfectly normal. If, however, you experience an intense sense of déjà vu, do be a blessed poppet and tell Latimer immediately. I do have such a fondness for Georgian architecture, and this drawing room is a fine example. The large window lets in that strange silvery light beautifully, and the high ceiling creates a wonderful space. Do take a seat on one of the wide sofas and enjoy the gentle twinkling of the lights on the Christmas tree. Of course, it may not be the festive season by the time some of you hear this, but inside this little time bubble, it will always be a few days until Christmas. Do forgive me if I sound a little nervous, but the guest coming to tea today is someone very special to me. She's one of my heroes, no less, and I'm so looking forward to introducing you.
I'm sorry to disturb you, Mum, but...
Is she here?
No, Mum. A parcel has arrived. It's rather large and making strange noises. And judging by the gaudy paper, I suspect it's a Christmas present.
How did a parcel arrive when we're slightly out of phase with the rest of space-time?
Via the same means the guest will use. I did explain it to you, Mum. Would you like me to repeat it?
Oh, no thanks. I suppose I should wait until Christmas to open it.
One moment, Mum. I've altered our position, and it will be Christmas for as long as you need it to be.
Oh, marvellous. Do bring the parcel in.
Very good, Mum. Oh. Just what you always wanted, Mum. A crate.
It's some sort of hutch, I think. Oh, here's a... Chickens!
I'll wring their necks immediately, Mum.
We can't eat them. They're so cute. Oh, there's a note. Merry Christmas, with love, an admirer. Ooh, how intriguing. Out you come, then.
I'm not sure the chickens should have the run of the house, Mum. What would your guest think?
She loves animals. It's fine. It can stop being Christmas now, Latimer.
Very good, Mum. I shall dispose of the paper.
Well, the chickens seem cheery enough. What an odd gift.
I'm sorry to disturb you, Mum, but your guest has arrived. A Miss Melinda Snodgrass.
Ah, oh, marvellous. Let's see her calling card. Melinda M. Snodgrass, dreamer. Oh, that picture of a lady with her horse is lovely.
Yes, she does seem very fond of them.
Show her in, Latimer. For those of you who don't know, Melinda Snodgrass is a novelist and screenwriter. You may be familiar with the episode of Star Trek The Next Generation she wrote, called Measure of a Man. Melinda writes science fiction and urban fantasy novels, and is the co-editor of the Wild Cards anthologies.
Miss Melinda Snodgrass, ma'am.
Melinda, it's such a pleasure to see you. Please do come and sit down. How are you?
Well, I'm fine, and thank you so much for having me. I hope you don't mind. Latimer gave me quite a stare because I just came from the barn, and so I'm a little bit in my horse dirt, as it were, and I hope you don't mind if I track it into this beautiful room, but, you know, boots.
Oh, no, that's fine. And I love the kind of the riding outfit look. I love that. I love the kind of the tailoring and the boots and all that. So, no, that's absolutely fine. Please do come and sit down.
Well, thank you.
And would you like a cup of tea?
Yes, please.
And how do you take your tea?
I like it with a splash of milk. And if you have Darjeeling, that would be delightful.
Do you take sugar or just a splash of milk?
Just a splash of milk.
I'll pour. And I was wondering if you'd like a cheeky little mince pie to go with that, seeing as it is the festive season.
Actually, I would think I would rather have one of those cakes. Mince and I've never quite understood the concept. Perhaps you can explain it to me, because I'm Anglophile in so many ways, but why you would put meat in a sweet, I'm confused.
It is actually deeply confusing, because we have beef mince, which is savory, and we put it into stews and things. But the mince in mince pies is actually fruit and alcohol.
Oh, well, alcohol, definitely.
Yes, so it's very, very rich, very, very sweet, and it's kind of tempered by the pastry. And they're splendid. Latimer makes a very, very mean mince pie.
I would like to try it.
And there's a dollop of cream on the side if you wish to partake of that.
Yes.
So, yes, I wanted to ask you about your passion for horse riding, because I understand that you do dressage, is that right?
That's right.
And you do that at a really high level.
Yes, I've been lucky enough. I haven't quite made it to the Grand Prix yet. I've ridden one level below. My last horse was a Grand Prix horse, and I managed to ride to Intermediaire 2, which is the level just below Grand Prix, and I know this sounds like another language, but it's something I'm passionate about. I do think it is a sport for people with OCD, though, because it's so precise and everything is done exactly at the correct moment, at the letter, when your knee crosses the letter on the ring. And if people are interested, I have a link to a magnificent ride at the World Cup on my Facebook page, where they can see what dressage actually is.
Oh, wonderful. I mean, I've watched it a little bit during the Olympics, but I have to confess it's not a world I know a great deal about. I was wondering what it is that's captivated you.
Well, aside from the fact, I simply adore horses, because they are the one creature that gives you back exactly what you give them. And that's just so wonderful. So your moods, you can calm yourself with a horse, because if you don't, you'll affect them. And that's a very healthy thing for riders, because I think we live in our own heads so much. But the other reason I love it is it's the closest thing to telepathy that I think we'll ever experience. And I'm a science fiction writer, so the idea of telepathy is fascinating to me. But the communication when my horse and I are in perfect sync, it's really mental. I mean, I know intellectually they're reading minute changes in my muscle tone, but it feels like Vento is reading my mind, that he's really responding to me, that, oh, we're going to go laterally across the ring now. And he seems to just do it because I've thought about it. And it's just this wonderful form of communication that we don't have with any other creatures. So that's why I love it. So,
do you think that it's something which encourages a deeper immersion than with other kind of animals or activities?
I think it encourages a different kind of emotion. I mean, I have cats and I've had dogs and I love them dearly. But with horses, they don't adore you in quite that, you know, no matter what you do to me, I'll love you, that dogs have. And my cats seem to love me, except I'm convinced they would eat me if I died. No one was feeding them. They would go, well, let's be practical about this. And horses, there's something magical about horses. And you can see it all through the history in literature and even in religion. I mean, the Arabic tradition to talk about, you know, the winds of the world blow between a horse's ears. I mean, there's just this sort of sense of freedom that you can go anywhere, and that there's this magnificent sense of a oneness that you have with a horse that you kind of don't have with other creatures. You don't really dominate a horse. You partner with a horse. And I think that's what appeals to us so deeply.
I wanted to ask, if you could teach anyone in the world to ride a horse, who would it be and why?
Oh, gosh. Anyone in the world.
Yeah, anyone in the world.
I would teach my friend George Martin. Because he writes, I mean, he's riding this giant fantasy, and I'm his horse expert. So I read the sections when he wants me to, that where he has horses. He goes, check out this horsey stuff. And I would love for him to experience, you know, what that is like, to be on an enormous, powerful animal that's become a war machine with you. Because I think that you can't quite capture it unless you've done it. And so he would be someone I would just love to teach to ride.
Not Tom Hiddleston, because that would be my first choice.
Well, but I've already seen Tom on a horse, and there's nothing he has to learn.
he can ride a horse, too.
I saw some clips of him in whatever the Three Crowns or whatever that show is, that I haven't managed to get a hold of, and he's on a horse. And I was admiring the fact that his feet are absolutely parallel to the body of the horse. And that's actually very difficult to achieve, and that's the sign of a good rider, because most people ride with their toes sort of splayed out. And he was perfect, you know. His leg was down the side of the horse, his feet were parallel to the shoulder of the horse, and I was going, oh, that's magnificent.
Oh, good grief. I'm starting to think that he must have made some kind of pact with the devil, because I don't think there is anything he cannot do. He can even dance, which is just quite frankly rude to be that talented.
Oh, yes, and that smile, even while Loki is doing something just hideous, he flashes that smile, and you go, okay, it's really not that bad, is it?
I know what you mean. It's terrible. How did we get on to Tom? That was probably my fault. I do apologize.
Oh, that's fine. I mean, at least you didn't mention Daniel Craig, because I feel like I betrayed James Bond because I've fallen in love with Loki now, and so I'm afraid that Bond just isn't making it right at the moment.
No, really. There's no comparison. I know from conversations we've had in the real world, not inside time bubbles such as this, that you moved from a legal career into your writing career. And I read a blog post that you wrote today about the joy of writing being the combination of dreaming and problem solving, which I thought was a really interesting thing to talk about. And I wondered if you moved from the legal career because there wasn't enough of the dreaming element, and whether that's the reason why writing fits you so much better.
I think that's true. I was an only child, so my made-up friends and my books were my companions. And so I could immerse myself in those worlds. I love the study of the law. To me, the law is a magnificent edifice. Unfortunately, the actual practice of the law is rather grubby. And I found that while I loved law, I didn't particularly like lawyers. There was this sense of being very closed in and not open to a lot of different input and experiences. And what changed my life was literally going to an autographing. A friend of mine who's a writer, Victor Milan, invited me to come to an autographing, a big clump of them. There were Roger Zelazny was there, and Susie McKee Charnas, and Fred Saberhagen. And after the autographing, the Saberhagens, who were very hospitable people, invited me to come home for a barbecue at their house. And I wandered from room to room just listening to conversations. And I overheard Fred talking about writing the Holmes Dracula file and getting these crazy letters from this guy in Romania who claimed he was a descendant of Dracula, but actually you could kind of tell from the letter that he really was implying he was Dracula. And then Susie McKee Charnas was having a discussion about the effects of language on culture, and how language develops. Vic and another younger writer were just incredibly witty. And I thought, these are the most fascinating people I have ever met in my life, and I want to be with them. Because when I was around lawyers, all they talked about were their billable hours. I couldn't live in that world. So I started writing in secret. Only Vic knew, because if I couldn't do it, I didn't want to, you know, make a big statement and fail. Mm. So I wrote in secret until I managed to sell my first book. I've done it now for so many years, and I've never looked back. It's what I really wanted to do when I grew up. It just took me a while to get here.
Mm.
I studied opera. I went to school in Vienna and studied opera. And while I have a good voice, I didn't have a great voice. I've been a lawyer. I thought about becoming a history professor. But it's like I found the right thing.
And, of course, you write for the screen as well as writing novels. And I was wondering what the difference is between the two media and what your feelings are about writing for each type.
I love doing both. They satisfy different needs. I think on balance, I prefer writing for the screen just because it's such a challenge to make everything work just in dialogue. And I love that game. And I also write, I'm a very visual writer. I unspool the movie in my head and then I just write down what I'm seeing. I've never been great at description. I really have enormous admiration for people who can do it well. For me, it's a struggle. I have to remind myself because I'm always hoping the art director will handle that and I don't have to. And internal dialogue, again, I feel like mine is awkward and you don't have to deal with any of that in a screenplay. If it's not there, if it's not in the words and going to be in the actor's mouth, it's not going to be there. And so the power of making something work in that focused way, I find to be just so much fun. What I enjoy about books is the opportunity to get deeper inside a person without having to rely on the actor to help you sell whatever it is you're trying to sell. I mean, there's a certain advantage to prose because you can tell the reader how someone is feeling. And when you're writing for the screen, you're at the mercy of who they cast and how good your director is. And so that's the difference. But I do enjoy them both. And truthfully, I think I became a better novelist after I went to Hollywood. I think I learned a lot of skills in Hollywood that have worked very well for prose writing.
Oh, that's interesting. So that one has given you transferable skills for the other.
Yes.
Ah, I know that in terms of my consumption of television and film, that I'm constantly analysing structure, and I could see how that could be something that you transfer from one to the other, that story structure and peaks and in the action and in the emotion. In my head, they're very similar. Is that actually the case, or is that clearly something that someone who doesn't do the screenwriting would say?
No, that's absolutely the case. Structure is king in a screenplay. If the structure isn't there, you can meander a bit in a novel. You can take a little side trip. You don't have that luxury in a screenplay because you only have 47 minutes in a one-hour drama or, you know, 2 hours, maybe a few minutes more for a screenplay. And actually, when I went to Hollywood, we had this technique called breaking a story. And we used a whiteboard on Star Trek, and then we used a corkboard and 3x5 cards on the other shows I worked on. And we would literally plot out a script, you know, write up teaser and then the number of acts, and then we would plot it in detail with every scene. And I brought that back to my writing group in New Mexico, and we do those kind of plot breaks now for people's novels. Someone will send out an email and say, hey, I need to work out my new book, and we'd all get together and I would bring a whiteboard or a corkboard and then we would go at it. Now, obviously you can't have every scene for a novel or you'd need, you know, 25 boards, but we still do it in acts. We do an act structure. We start with the act outs and plot backwards. We do all of those things that I learned in Hollywood, and we've adapted it for novel writing here with a number of us who tend to be more architects in our approach to writing rather than gardeners, which is what George, I guess another word for it is pantsers. Mm-hmm. I'm not a pantser or a gardener. I'm an architect. I want to know where I'm going.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting stuff. You know, I've just realized I was so excited to see you and distracted by the horse riding gear that I forgot to ask you about the curio that I invited you to bring with you. I do apologize.
But that's quite all right. And actually, it ties in very nicely to what we were talking about plot breaking. Because my curio is, well, it's about 12 inches long and about a half an inch in diameter, and it's clear lucite. And it's filled with stars and glitter in various shades of purples and blues. And it was meant to be a magic wand, but it was given to me as a gift when I went to work on Star Trek by a friend. And we used to hand it around in these meetings, and people would play with it and stare at the glitter and the stars rolling through the tube. And then one day, one of the other writers said, give me that dumb stick. I want to see something foolish. And so we handed it over to him, and he held it up proudly and then made an absolutely ridiculous statement. He was like, well, why don't we do this in the story? And it truly was an incredibly stupid remark. But it kind of generated a new direction, and we all went off in that way, and we found that it was very useful, and we got, and the plot moved forward because we found a new way to approach this problem. So the dumb stick became essential in our plotting sessions, and I still have it. And every time we do a plot break in New Mexico, the dumb stick comes along because it gives you permission to say something very foolish. And great. George, if I don't happen to have it with me, when George and I are working on, say, wild cards, George will say, okay, I'm holding the metaphoric dumb stick. But I try to have it with me for every kind of plotting session because it just gives people that freedom to occasionally be foolish. And I think that's very healthy because sometimes sounding silly can lead you to something really good.
Yes, I completely agree. That's wonderful. I'm having a little bit of a Star Trek geek moment. Please excuse me. I've got a little bit flush there. I love hearing of the kind of the behind the scenes aspects. And I was a little bit uncertain about speaking to you about Measure of a Man, your most famous Next Generation episode, because it's something that you did a long time ago and you've done so many wonderful things since. I hate the idea of that being the only thing that we talk about in relation to you and your work. But we're talking about Star Trek now, so I'm going to dive in and say for the public record that it is my favourite episode and something very, very dear to me on a personal level, which I've shared with you privately. I went on the Twitters earlier, as I'm wont to do before I have a guest, and I said, I'm going to be interviewing the writer of Measure of a Man, and it was just absolute reams of people retweeting and getting very excited and people saying, I teach that in my class as an example of perfect composition, and that's my favourite episode. And it is something which is so important for so many people. Do you still love it all these years later?
I do, and I'm very gratified by the reaction, and I'm humbled by the fact that this episode has meant so much to so many people, and it still touches me and affects me. I'm proud of it, yes, and I'm pleased to have had the opportunity to write something that has touched people. It means a great deal to me. It came up because I grew up on old Star Trek, the original series, when I was a little girl. It was the first time I'd gotten to see my dreams on screen. And when I went to write this script for Next Generation, this was my spec script. This was my submission script to see if I could get a script assignment from them. I never dreamed they would buy it because George had told me that they wouldn't, because nobody ever buys their spec script. They don't sell it. But I wanted to write something that had the heart of the old show, because despite the cheesy effects and the overacting and so on and so on, there was something deeply moving about a lot of episodes in the original show. And I kind of wanted to capture that and those large issues that people discussed. And my legal training had given me a perfect case to use as the foundation, which was the Dred Scott decision, which is a very infamous Supreme Court decision in the United States that basically decreed that a man of African American descent was in fact property and not a person. And I thought this would work perfectly for Data. And I thought he was, frankly, the most interesting character in Next Generation, because he wasn't formed, and he was figuring out who he was. And I think most of us spend our lives trying to figure out who we are. And so he was, therefore, he had a lot of handles, a lot of ways you could get into the character and write about him.
The Ensigns of Command as well is one that I'm very, very fond of, and seeing him kind of wrestling with a problem in the way that he has to in that episode, I love that as well. Somebody asked on the Twitters whether there were any major changes to the script of Measure of a Man.
No, it was remarkable. That one simply sailed through. I did get notes and I did rewrite, but they were my rewrites and they were minor. They were expanding Picard's conversation with Guinan. That was the major place. My boss, Maury, wanted more. He wanted more in that conversation, and so I had to find the right way into it. And she wasn't supposed to be in the episode. Then they realized that under Whoopi's contract, she needed to be in an episode, and they decided she needed to be in this one. And so I had to add her in. So that was actually one of the larger changes, and it turned out to be simply brilliant. I mean, having her there meant there was a sounding board for Picard. And so that scene came up because of something very mundane, which was a contractual agreement with the actress. And, you know, I love that kind of thing where it's on the fly and you've got to fix it. I mean, that's one of the things I truly enjoy about Hollywood. It's like a high wire act with no net, and it's fun. That was my first big experience with it.
One of the things that I love about that episode as well is, obviously it's a Data episode, but it also deepened Picard for me because of the relationship he has with the judge. Is it Lavoie? And I loved her as well. She was just such a character. And that there was this kind of friction and respect and frustration between them. And it just, it suddenly was like he was more of a character. He had a proper past and a previous relationship outside of the show as I'd seen it up until that point, and that was the other aspect I really loved. I was wondering if you based her on anybody that you knew in your legal world.
A little bit on an older woman lawyer that was in the law firm where I worked, or she had office space in that office building. And she was a very early, I mean, she was a woman in her 70s when I met her. And so she was one of the women who had fought her way into the legal profession before there were very many of us there. And she had a sort of wonderful edge to her. And so she was a bit of it. And also, I think that's where my book writing that I had been doing before I went to Hollywood actually helped Hollywood, because it did feel like these characters had no existence outside of the Enterprise. And of course, they would have had lives and they would have served on other ships and done other things. And I wanted this sense of people who existed outside the confines of that spaceship. And so I brought that in, and I think that was something that hadn't really been done all that often. I also like the episode because I felt it, I love the character of Riker, and I thought he was never fully used properly. And so I wanted to give Riker a chance to shine a little bit. And I had a friend who is a Navy commander who gave me the perfect fix, because he told me about how if you are at sea and you can't get back to shore and to a JAG office, Judge Advocate General, they're the lawyers in the military, then when you have to hold a court case on a ship and you're out to sea, the captain defends and the first officer prosecutes. And I thought, oh, this is perfect, because I finally have some friction between these terribly perfect people who all seem to get along so well.
Yeah.
And I wanted to rough them up a little bit.
And I like that as well, because it deepened Riker, because he had the struggle of needing to do his job contrary to what he wanted. You're entirely right about Riker, that there were so few episodes where there was any kind of meat.
Yeah. And Jonathan is quite a good actor. I mean, and he got it. He got the fact that while he doesn't want to hurt Data, he badly wants to beat Picard. Mm. And that came across, and I liked that. I mean, that was sort of subversive, because, of course, after that episode, he's constantly saying, oh, no, I couldn't possibly take a promotion. You know, my God, I can't leave you, Captain Picard. And I was like, there isn't a military officer alive who would say it that way. But I wanted to give him the sense that he is in competition with this man, and he wants to prove he's as good, if not better. And I thought Jonathan did a beautiful job of pulling that off. And it's interesting, because in the extended version, there was a scene that clearly presents that, and it got cut because the episode came in horribly long. But it got put back in for the extended version that's on the DVD, and I'm really glad to see it back, because it was the moment where we see the tension between the two men.
Who decides what's cut out and what stays? Is that all the editor?
Well, it's the editor together with the executive, with the top producers. And Star Trek was an odd show because normally the writer of an episode is also in the editing room. But Star Trek had a very strange way of working, and they didn't let us have any involvement in casting or editing or any of these other things, which is not the norm. When I went on to work on a show called Reasonable Doubts, I could go to editing and watch and, you know, occasionally make a comment. And so it's generally done in conference together of people figuring it out. And editors are brilliant. Editors can rescue your script. I mean, if the show isn't working, they can rewrite it by editing it. And I've seen it happen a time or two with freelance scripts that didn't work. And the editor has pulled it together in the editing room. So.
The sense of having to relinquish control is something that I find enticing but also horrifying at the same time. Do you ever feel a conflict in yourself with that, or is it not as bad as I imagine?
I think it depends on your personality. I love the collaborative method. I wish in some ways that I could be in a writer's room even when I'm doing my novels. The ability to walk next door to somebody and go, I'm really stuck on this scene. Can I run this by you? And just talk. I'm a person who I need to talk things out to make them work. I know other writers need to keep it very close to their hearts and very private. And that kind of person would not do well in Hollywood, because you have to be able to share it with the actors, the directors, your other fellow writers. People are going to have input. I really enjoy that. Some of it also comes with experience. In the beginning, I was probably more protective. Now I understand my job. And my job is to try to work in conjunction with these other people in a collaborative way and make it work. And if an actor can't say a line, I might love that line, but I need to change it. And producers and directors will come in and go, you know, this green ribbon, I don't like it. Can you make it purple? And you say, okay, and you make it purple. And then I go back to books, and then I get to just have it all be me. And so I love the balance, and I think I want to keep a foot in each camp because of that. I think it's good for me to need to react and then also to be queen of my domain.
It's interesting you say that, because it depends on the novel. I've just finished a novel where I was very much by myself, and there were only occasional times when I'd go to Peter, my husband, and say, actually, I just need to talk this stuff out because I'm stuck. But with the Split Worlds novels, there would be hours and hours of conversation with him where we would bounce ideas and throw it around, which I imagine is quite a similar process. Yes, Latimer?
I'm sorry to disturb you, ma'am, but we've arrived at our destination. We're now just over a mile away from the town of Waterloo on the 17th of June, 1815.
Why do you have that strange hat?
Ah, this is a special hat, ma'am, a time travel hat.
I would have thought that trousers would be more convenient for time travel.
They were stolen, ma'am. This hat permits the wearer to leave the protection of the time bubble and pass unnoticed. I thought that, if I may be so bold, Miss Snodgrass, you might like to venture out and see the sights.
Oh, I would be delighted. Yes, please.
So far, that's very kind, Latimer. Thank you. I don't think we've got too much more to discuss, and this teapot is getting a little bit empty. This is a rather good choice of Latimer's, because we can look out of the window now and watch all of the officers walking past. I do like the clothes of this period.
Yes, I do too. But only on a gentleman with a good leg and a nice hip to wear those nice tight breeches.
Yes, it's true. It's just such a shame these days that people don't dress up as much as they used to. And I say this knowing full well that I would hate it if I had to spend 2 hours getting dressed every day. But there is something that has been lost, I think.
I completely agree. And a well-dressed man is just, he's so elegant, and especially if he can dance. That's for me the ultimate attraction is to glide into a man's arms and glide across a ballroom is just one of my favorite things.
Yes, I mean, I'd like to fantasize about that. I wouldn't be able to do it in real life, because I can't dance to save my life. But yes, it's nice to imagine. So moving away from the screenwriting to the novels, and I know that you're writing urban fantasy at the moment because we're friends online and I've seen you talking about it lately. I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about the series.
The first book is called This Case Is Going to Kill Me, and then Box Office Poison. And once again, even though I ultimately didn't spend very much time as a lawyer, I used it enormously in my writing. I mean, Measure I wrote because of my training. And these books are about a young woman lawyer, a human woman, who works in a vampire law firm in New York City. And so I wanted to examine how urban fantasy would be different if you were dealing with sort of the top levels of society, the top law firms, politics, business, Wall Street, those kind of places, and how vampires and werewolves and so forth would affect that. Because it struck me that if these creatures really existed, they would probably be pretty powerful. And nobody had that I could see had written about that particular strata of society. And I wanted to. And it was a good way to use my legal training and to think about how the law would change if these people existed. So that was sort of the genesis of the books. And the first book is based on a somewhat very loosely, I say, anybody who might be listening, on a case when I was working for a corporate law firm of an ongoing argument over a will that had gone on for decades, where the people were fighting about this estate. And then the second book, I set in Hollywood so that I could write about my experiences there, but kind of cast it in from a legal perspective. The conceit of the book is that the elves, I have elves in my universe too, I call them Alfar, and they're so beautiful and they're so charismatic that they're getting all the roles. And so the human actors in SAG have brought a lawsuit to sue the elf actors because they're not getting any parts. Rather than go to court, they're in arbitration. And my young attorney is acting as an arbitration judge in this hearing. But she's also exploring Hollywood and all that experience while she's there. So that's the latest book. And I'm in the process of writing the third book, and I'm almost done.
So you write, these books have been published with the name of Philippa Bornikova, and I was quite curious about that.
I did that because I felt that there's an issue of reader expectation in the way people consume media today. People, especially with cable and gaming and streaming, people can really tailor what they want to view, play, read. And I felt like it was important that I not confuse the readers, because Melinda writes a certain kind of book. My edge books are much more about the war between science and rationality and religion and superstition, and they're much more serious. And I felt like the readers who like those books would be put off by the lighter tone of these urban fantasies. And so I didn't want that confusion in the readers' minds. I was fairly crass in the selection of the B, Bornikova. My name's Snodgrass. I'm always on a bottom shelf somewhere. And I find that people don't bend over that. I wanted a name that actually was sort of at eye level on the shelves. There was that. And I was also sort of trying to cozy up to like Jim Butcher, these other people who are very famous and very successful, so that perhaps my book would get noticed. So those were the reasons why I chose to go with the name. And I picked Philippa because it means lover of horses.
Ah.
So it's my little private thing about me, that's in there.
Cool. Right. Well, I think before this chicken pecks a hole through the rug, there was just one last question I wanted to ask you whilst I pour the last cup. If you had to pick a theme tune for yourself, what theme tune would you choose?
Oh, that's a hard one. I love music so much because I studied it and I sang and I adore it. But I went round and round, and I think I would have to go with this wonderful call to arms that's in the musical Les Miserables. Do You Hear the People Sing? And I love it. It's this, sense of wanting justice, and I think that's kind of part of my nature, why I write, and because I write because I want to talk about things that are important to me. So I think I would have to go with that.
That's a wonderful, wonderful tune. Oh, the chickens. Latimer, the chickens. What a marvelous gift. I received these earlier from, an admirer, the note said. And they sent this pair of chickens, and I thought that they would just lay eggs. I didn't realise they would be musical chickens.
These are magical chickens. That's remarkable.
And to think Latimer wanted to eat them.
Oh, no, Latimer, you must. These are magic chickens. And I think we should go on the road with these chickens.
Well, I think they may have to come to tea in the future. I have eked all I can out of this teapot. And I can see that outside there are all kinds of exciting things happening. We're thankfully quite a distance away from the main areas of slaughter. It does look like there's a nice area where you could have a stroll around and have a look and get in the sights and smells of the Napoleonic era, if you're amenable.
Oh, I would love to. And look, there's a line of horses that are over there and the gentleman going past. I would love to have been a cavalry officer for the Duke of Wellington. So I'll just slip out and take a look.
Marvelous. Don't forget the hat.
Oh, yeah, thank you. Yes, they would be shocked to see a lady in breeches and boots, wouldn't they?
Yes, they would. And I understand, Latimer, that it means that no one can see Melinda. Is that right?
Yes, ma'am. She will be quite safe.
Good. Excellent. Well, Melinda, if I don't have the opportunity, in case I'm called away whilst you're enjoying the sights, I would like to say thank you so much for coming to take tea with me today.
Well, thank you so very much for having me. This has been delightful. The architecture, the Christmas tree, it's all been so cozy and quite warm. It's quite chilly in New Mexico, so I've very much enjoyed it. But if you slip away, I do hope Latimer will slip away with a time bubble because, well, I would be stranded and that would
No. I promise you, I give you my word that you will not be stranded here. Isn't that right, Latimer?
Yes, ma'am.
Well, very good then. Well, Emma, thank you so very much, and you have a wonderful holiday. And I will, I'll be back in a little while.
Okay, have fun.
Thank you.
Don't get into any trouble.
Oh, I won't. I promise you, I'm the soul of discretion.
Wonderful. Well, I'll watch you from the window.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.
It's a rather ostentatious hat, Latimer.
I thought Miss Snodgrass had the strength of character required for such a large feather, ma'am.
I suppose it goes with the bright red diodes across the crown. She does look very happy out there. Perhaps I'll go and have a look around later once we've taken her home.
Yes, ma'am.
Latimer, why are those British officers pointing at Melinda? I thought they weren't supposed to be able to see her.
I say, who are you?
Ah, it's raining, ma'am. It may have shorted out the...
You're a British butler, and you didn't think to make a time travel hat waterproof?
May I point out, we're in Belgium, ma'am. Actually, on today's date, we're in the United Kingdom of the Netherlands.
Yeah, I don't like that damned hat. It's like to be more my bloody Frenchman.
Oh, no, they'll think she's a French spy.
Well, don't worry, ma'am. They won't kill her. They'll want to interrogate her first.
This is simply unacceptable. Oh, no, wait a minute. We're in a time bubble machine thing. We can just go back to earlier today. You can cover the hat in something waterproof
and then... It seems Miss Snodgrass has a solution of her own. She evidently had some sort of horse treat left in her pocket.
Well, it's lucky she did. She's got that horse to throw the officer. She's getting on it. Heavens to Betsy, she is brilliant.
She's not going to ride that beast into the house, surely?
Can the officers see the house?
Of course not, ma'am.
But how will Melinda be able to see it to get back in?
Well, to everyone else, we're invisible. But the hat will allow her to... Ah.
Switch off the bubble so she can see where to go.
But, ma'am...
Now, Latimer, quick, she's starting to gallop.
Come on, boy, come on. That's a good fellow. Kendra, come on, gallop, gallop, good boy. Latimer, open the door. Latimer, would you open the damn door?
Phew, she's safely inside. Thank goodness for that. Settle down, chickens. She's fine. As Latimer and Melinda take care of the horse, I'd like to thank you for joining the deeply brilliant Melinda Snodgrass and I today. Now the entirety of the space-time continuum is available to us, the possible locations for tea layers seem endless. I was wondering if there was a particular point in the space-time continuum you'd especially like to visit. If so, let me know on the Twitters, I'm Emapocalyptic over there, or in the comments for this episode on tnjeopardy.com. Dear listeners, if this is the first time you've joined us for Tea and Cake in the Tea Lair, you can find other episodes at www.tnjeopardy.com. Well, until next time, my Christmas puddings. I hope you have a fabulous festive season, and we will take tea together in the new year. Now, Latimer, once we've taken Melinda home...
And once I've cleaned the entrance hall...
Could you find a way to rescue that chicken from the chandelier? I've no idea how it got up there.
Very good, Mum.
You've just listened to an episode of Tea and Jeopardy, hosted by Emma Newman. Go to www.teaandjeopardy.com to find out more and join in.